I read them. I'll comment on it later. You have no idea how thwarted I am, but something happened. You'll see. I'm going to give you something beautiful. You'll see. Okay. Today is Monday, the 22nd of October, 2012. And once again, I want to thank all the fabulous students sitting in front of me. Sam, I want you to know I met an English girl Friday night in my daughter's home, and she said she knew you. If I knew the name, I'd be a genius. I was introduced to so many people, the names went right by me. And I want to say good morning to all those listening. I just want to fill in with some of the correspondence. Dr. Marty Lipson, remember we spoke about shell shock. So Marty, Dr. Lipson of Toronto sent me an email. The current description of the mental condition formerly called shell shock or battle fatigue is post-traumatic stress disorder. I think I'll stick to shell shock. It's a little bit easier. But you know when we mentioned that, Daniel, you know when we mentioned that in relation to the woman, remember with the shell shock? What went on with the two women? By the way, the woman who killed the terrorist was a religious girl, was a product of an ulpana and a frum girl, and the other woman that you know who hid in I don't know where, but God have mercy, under a tree, and the army thought she was kidnapped. You don't know what that meant to the army. Well, how much worry went into those minutes, hours, until she made contact. So the word is post-traumatic stress disorder. Thank you, Dr. Marty Lipson, but it's a little hard. Shell shock is a little bit easier, even if it's not correct in the year 2013. Now, remember I told you a story about Rabbi Nassim Zuba. I don't know if I told it in this class, or I think I told it in the class where I spoke about Kosher Mishpat, the Sunday class. So believe it or not, listening to the lectures is the Shaluach of Chabad in, let me get, it's in Washington State. One second, let's see if I get the city here. Yeah, it's Olympia, Washington. So the Shaluach sent me an email that this is his great uncle. And he couldn't believe I knew the story. And the story is very simple. It happened with the fifth Rebbe, with Reb Shalom Dovber, I believe, that one of the mashpiyim in the yeshiva, in Chabad, you don't have a mashkiach, you have a mashpia. So the mashpia had a son who went to university and came back either without a beard or with a trim beard. And the sixth Rebbe, who was the menahel of the yeshiva, called him into the office and told him off, how can it be? Your father's a mashpin Chabad, you don't have a beard. And the young Nassim Zuba, who was a student in Tomchei Tumimim, came into the man who would be the sixth Rebbe and gave endless pshatim why it's mutter not to have a beard. I can also bring sources. It's not so hard. Mayit katan, if you know what I'm talking about. The Mishnah quite clearly indicates you don't have to have a beard. So, Jews didn't have beards. So that's when the Rebbe told him, and he gave me, I remember the exact words, Lernen kenstu, or the Ashegitz bistu. And then, 20 years later, when Rabbi Zucker went into Yechidit with the sixth Rebbe in Crown Heights, and Rabbi Nathan Zuba was clean shaven, the Rebbe said to him, now I understand, you wouldn't be Melamed Skut on the son of the Mashpia, but you're being Melamed Skut on yourself, that you go around without a beard. Now, about this Rabbi Zuba, his great nephew, Rabbi Chesky Edelman, says that his father told him that Rabbi Zuba, my grandfather, said that my Zayda Zuba knew Shas like I knew Ashrei. So you understand the family he's coming from. Okay, and finally, I want to correct a mistake. I mentioned about the book that the Rav, the Zish Halacha, and what was the one that came out, the Halachic Man or the Halachic Mind. Halachic Mind So I said in class, it was published posthumously. I want to correct myself. It was not published posthumously. The Rebbe was still alive, but the Rebbe was not functioning. It was already published. I believe it was 86. They found the manuscript in a drawer in his house, and that was the manuscript that was published. But I made a slight error when I said posthumously, but it was not published by the Rebbe. It was published by his children. Okay, we're ready to roll, and it's a very fascinating shiur, what we're doing, what we're going into. Isaac Lisa had very little muscle in his life, very little muscle in his death. In his life, he never married, he was ill, his brother died contracting the disease when he came to visit him, smallpox. Isaac Lisa was the first Rebbe in America to have vision. Everything he dreamt about did not come to fruition in his lifetime, but came to fruition afterwards. The tragedy in his death is simply that the conservative movement claimed them as one of their own, and as I showed you last week, Moshe Davis and his doctorate, The Emergence of Conservative Judaism, as Isaac Lisa in the historical school, he admits, albeit the right wing of the historical school, but the historical school nevertheless. And I even showed you the volume of Landau, Yonah Landau, the Satma, who writes this entire volume about Rav HaKolel, and he writes about Isaac Lisa. He defends him. He said he didn't rip the hell out of the conservatives. Of course, the conservatives didn't exist at that time. But all right, he means the Reformed Jews, because he didn't use strong language. They claim him as one of their own, but he gives him the name Reb Yitzchak Lesser. He even gives him the wrong name, but at least he gives him covet and honor. Now, you see, time is moving on, and I ended off the class last week. And you have to look at a map to appreciate this. Jews are pouring into America. It's after the Civil War. As I explained to you, and it's a famous comment of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, I feel like I lived it myself, although I never saw Europe in the 1800s. But I told you, and I told you this, I'll repeat it again, I have it on tape, I have the Rebbe on tape. Yoni, I'm a shtickler chassid too. I appreciate that. You know, you got to know who the Rebbe was and his thinking and his dreams. So a bit of a chassid I am. Although I'm not a chassid, I'm an independent, old-fashioned Litvak. But a feeling, habichya, a feeling I do have. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe, when he introduced that Moshe, that women should light Shabbos candles with girls, so he was very heavily attacked. And everyone said the Rebbe is changing Minhag Yisrael, what we spoke about in class yesterday, what we're going to speak next week. By the way, thank you for your nice words about yesterday's Shia. Don't think it's not appreciated. I was very moved. So many people have said to me after Shia, they understand the effort I put in. All right? It's these Shia Makulo Chiddush. I create them, and I say that I appreciate the fact that you appreciate that my life circles around the Shiurim. Okay, so orbits around the Shiurim. So the Rebbe comes under attack, and it's the Yutet Kislev, and the Rebbe says, everyone is attacking me, and he says, tell me, do you read newspapers today? And you know, the audience is laughing. He says, who read a newspaper 100 years ago? And then the Rebbe says, I'll tell you how the Jews got their news. And he describes the shul haif. Now, those words, the shul haif, you don't start to appreciate it. But if you look at the shuls, if you look at the shuls in Europe, sit close, Yosef. If you look at the shuls in Europe, every shul was surrounded by a courtyard. And in the courtyard, a lot of the balabatim, you think they were all tzaddikim in Europe and everyone was learning. The balabatim went out and sat in the courtyard. They exchanged gossip. So there was one person who heard from a newspaper that someone got that the news was already 2 months old. But he told them about the Civil War. And he said, no one complains that buying a newspaper is something innovative, something new. But when I tell the women to light Shabbos candles, they complain, and the Rebbe defends himself. But you see, from the shul haif, people learned about America. And you now have East European Jews starting to come into America. You have Jews from Central Europe, close to East European, coming to America. By and large, the religious feeling, and I don't want to be a fool because, Josh, how do you measure religious feeling? You follow me? There's no machine that I know of to measure religious feeling. But by and large, the religious feeling among the Bavarian Jews, the Czechoslovakia, what we call Czechoslovakia today, Romania, and certainly when you come to Poland, Ukraine, Lithuania, as you move east, the religious feeling becomes deeper. And of course, the reason is very simple. German Jewry was destroyed by the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment came in Germany. And I always use a very simple example. You know, people don't understand the Enlightenment. If you were educated in Bnei Brak, in a very narrow environment, and suddenly you move to Kalamazoo, Michigan, or suddenly you move to Moscow, Russia, today you can move, it's a different world. You'll be overwhelmed, you'll be shocked. The light, it's like going into a cave. You go into a cave, you can't see. You come out of the cave, you're blinded by the sun. It takes a good few minutes until you can see properly. And that was the Enlightenment. Reb Moshe Mendelssohn was a frum Jew, but his kids couldn't handle it. The grandchildren couldn't handle it. And German Jewry fell away. But as you move more east, it's 50 years after the Enlightenment began, 100 years after the Enlightenment began, they were able to handle it. They were able to handle it ever so slightly. And they're now in America. And there is some religious feeling. Baruch Hashem. They don't let you live, yes, if they don't let you live. You see, but I want to give you advice. You have to have the song on it, Hatikva. Change it to Hatikva. So when it rings, everyone will stand up with respect. And believe me, you earned Hatikva, and I also earned Hatikva, Baruch Hashem, and Shmuel too earned Hatikva. Gentlemen, not only that, by the 1870s, the 1880s, some of the East European, some of the East European Jews had succeeded in America. And some of them had money. The American dream. Not every East European was a schnorrer. Some of them went into business, some of them bought real estate, some of them had money. As a matter of fact, rabbinic literature develops a new title for Jews with money, Nagid, Nigidim. We know the title Nagid. Now tell me, how many of you have learned the Perush of Rav Shmuel HaNagid in back of Masechet Brachot? What does Rav Shmuel HaNagid mean? That he was authority. He was recognized by the government, by the non-Jewish government. The Jews looked up to him. You now have a turn in rabbinic literature, Nagid. And that means a Jew who made it in America. A Jew who couldn't speak a proper English. A Jew had not gedet Yiddish and getracht in Yiddish. His thought process was Yiddish. But he tried to speak English. And he knew how to run a business. And he made money. Oh boy. And in America, with money, you get honey. And there's a second part to it. When a Jew makes money in America, he thinks he knows it all. This is America. It's not Europe. In Europe, how wealthy was the Chafetz Chaim? No, what do you say, Sam? Fill me in. How wealthy was the Chafetz Chaim? Harry Fischel visited the Chafetz Chaim. Harry Fischel, the first man to give what is today Yeshiva University, 100 $100,000 in the 1920s. Harry Fischel visited the Chafetz Chaim and said, Rebbe, what kind of furniture is this? What are you sitting on? I want to, and Harry Fischel, with a few hundred dollars, you know how far it went in Poland at that time? Harry Fischel wants to outfit the Chafetz Chaim's house. And the Chafetz Chaim says, Mr. Fischel, when you're at home, what is your furniture like? And Mr. Fischel describes, he has a 10-room apartment on the Upper East Side, luxurious carpeting, sofas. And now that you're traveling, Mr. Fischel, what is your home like? And Harry Fischel says, well, I have very little. I'm in a little hotel room. I'm in Raten. I'm in Vilna. What kind of facilities? But I'm traveling. And the Chafetz Chaim says, Mr. Fischel, I am traveling. This world, I'm a temporary guest. The next world is the real world. And I don't need good furniture in this world. I'm in a hotel. Here today, gone tomorrow. And he refused to let Mr. Fischel, Harry Fischel, outfit his house. But you see, in America, you have an agid. They have an opinion. They have money. We can't win today. Baruch Hashem. Okay. They saw your payers, they got frightened. Okay. An agid has an opinion. You see, this is something new. In Europe, who? Rav Chaim Brisker had an opinion. No, you know the way Rav Chaim Brisker lived? Read Rakefet's work on Rav Chaim, where he describes Rav Chaim word by word. Did Rakefet know Rav Chaim Brisker? But he quotes the Rav word by word, describing his Zayda. In the house, any poor man could walk in, found a bed, a couch, a bench, lay down, went to sleep. No one could wake him up. Rav Chaim, a poor man, a gast, a chesed. This would be the Rav Chaim. What kind of bank account did he have? But Rav Chaim Brisker ruled. In America, you're developing a whole new concept. Not the rabbis, the balabatim, the negidim rule. And I'll give you an example if you need. I cannot give you a better example than a live example from today. There's a shul, it's probably the second most important shul in America. Kehilat Jeshurun is probably the first most important, and Beth Jacob of Beverly Hills is the second most important. Now you check out their record. They have had infight after infight after infight. They just had a Shabbos, I got a report from Los Angeles, just had a Shabbos of unity. For the first time, everyone in the shul should sit together and stop fighting for one Shabbos Suda. Why do they fight? So I tell you, rabbis come, rabbis go, rabbis remain there with endless Akmas Nefesh. So I that was explained to me very simply. You're dealing in Beverly Hills and Beth Jacob with endless Balabatim who have made tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars. You know what you're dealing with there? No, these men, you're going to tell them something? A guy who made $200 million in 2 years' time during the recession, the rabbi's going to tell him something about another, but I know, I run a business, I can run a shul. And these are negidim, these are balabatim. This is America. And I can tell you an incident. I was there a year and a half ago. So I spoke here, I spoke there, I spoke many times, 2 weeks. I spoke, I think, 22 times in the community, various different locations. So the final Sunday, the Monday, I was flying to Seattle. So on Sunday, some of the Balabatim say to me, Rav Rakefet, you're a miracle. Everyone loves you. No machloket over you. I say, sure, because I'm not the rabbi. The minute I would become the rabbi and have to express an opinion on a topic, 51% would agree with me and 49% would oppose me. You follow me, Ellie? You got to know what America is about. Now, when you're rich, you have an opinion, you're respected, you build stairs going to nowhere. and everyone respects you. No one's going to ask you, why'd you build these stairs? It doesn't go to anywhere. No, a rich man can do whatever he wants. Now, this is very important because this is unique to America. The Rav used to say, when I say the Rav, I mean Rav Soloveitchik, Moriah Rebbe. The Moriah Rebbe, Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, the Rav used to say that America is the first Jewish community which was not established by Rabbanim. It was established by Balabatim. And it's an interesting thought. And until today, the Balabatim rule. The Balabatim are the bosses. All right, today you have Rabbanim, you have Muetzet Gedolei HaTorah in the Aguda world. I'm not even certain the Aguda world, whether the Muetzet is the same authority it was in Europe. These are American Balabatim who think, who are innovative, who make a heck of a lot of money, and they're not going to let anyone tell them what to do. Now, one of the people who came in Aliyah at this time was Moshe Weinberg. His biography, I'll give you the source now. People Walk on Their Heads. It's an English translation of Moses Weinberger's Jews and Judaism in New York. It's a very fascinating volume. I don't know whether it's still for sale. It came out 30 years ago, but it's a volume you have to read to believe. Translated from the Hebrew by Jonathan Sonner. Jonathan Sonner, you all know, professor of Jewish sociology, I believe. What is he, a graduate of JTS or Yeshiva College? I don't even know myself. Anyone? I know he's a Shomer Torah Mitzvah 100%. Jonathan Sonner, his father taught at JTS. That much I do know. Professor Sonner taught Bible. I don't know whether he's related to the Chevron family. It has to be checked out. There's the Sonner family that descends from the Levush Mordechai, from Mordechai Epstein, Rashi Yeshiva, a few minutes walk from here in Chevron Yeshiva. Now, this Moses Weinberger, in the introduction, they give his biography. First of all, his years, 1854-1940. Born in Hungary, Talmud Chacham, had smicha, 26 years old when he comes to America. And to use a little Yiddish, emuchetzich. How do you translate that? He's tortured, he struggles. It's not easy for him. He's a Rav. They're Hungarian shuls, but this is America. The Balabatim prefer a chazan, not a Rav. This is very fascinating. In Europe, everyone went to hear a darshan. In America, Yossel Rosenblatt sang in a shul. You had to buy a ticket, and they gave you a bindle. How do you say that in English? A string to tie around your finger. And if you showed the string, you were, because you couldn't carry. There was no Erev. If you wore the string on Shabbos, that's how you got into the shul to hear the chazan. And I have to tell you, this continues until today. Let me take you to communist Russia. Communist Russia, you all, I trust, have studied, and I apologize, Daniel. Washington is not my book. It was published by a publisher. Say them. You don't publish books like that to make a living. You publish books like that to create Torah and Yirat Shemayim. I hope I have. I'm quoted. I'll show you something nice if I have time later. So, Malk and I worked for the Mossad. We had to send shlichim. It's all in the book. I'm allowed to talk about it today. That's how I met Yosef Begun, January 1981, in Moscow, running away from the KGB between two jail sentences, and the second to the third, running away, not allowed into Moscow. He's in exile, teaching Talmud. So we had to continue the chain. So among the people I sent a zug. Everyone had to go with someone else, preferably your wife. But Rabbi Dr. David Applebaum had little children, so my dear student Deborah Sparrow Applebaum stayed at home, and he went with a person from Efrat who's a shtickel chazan. And David, what a personality, what a character, what knowledge. And the chazan is with him. Years went by, and one of the famous refuseniks gets out. Kogan, naming anything to you, from Leningrad. Yitzchak Kogan, Isaac Kogan. So Isaac Kogan gets out, it's about 86, 87, and the head of our division in the Mossad says to me, Harav Rakefet, ata yechol hazmina kol ha-shlichim shelcha, Kogan magia, rak ten yi reshima, v'niyasadetza im bitachon. You know, he's going to have a special reception at Lod Airport. In order to get home, you have to have security, and give me a list, invite all your people that you sent, and they will be allowed into the VIP lounge where there's going to be this Kabbalat Panim for Isaac Kogan. So David and his partner are there, and here is Yitzchak Kogan finally coming. There are movies of this with a long beard, a chabadnik by now, and he sees David, doesn't mean anything. He sees Zalman Deutsch, David's partner. Zalman, find on our little starter song, ich hab viel gewart, I waited a long time to hear you sing some chazanis again. And boy, I said to David, take a look. David Applebaum, Talmid Muvhak of Rabbaran Soloveitchik, the top emergency doctor in all of the state of Israel, acknowledged far and wide for innovative methods of bringing people back to life. And take a look, the Russians don't even know your name, forgot you completely, don't even pay attention. And Zalman Deutsch, an architect from Efrat, who's a first-class chazan, take a look at the way Yitzchak Kogan, his face lights up. Let me hear a little chazanish again. See, this was America. How's this poor rabbi going to make a living? A muchitzach, he's suffering, and he finally tries to establish a Talmud Torah that will be on a level, that they'll teach the kids Yiddishkeit, they'll teach the kids how to daven, they'll teach the kids Chumash, the teachers will be paid, and he writes this book that I'm quoting from as a fundraiser for this Talmud Torah. But in the book he pleads, listen to me, don't come to America, stay home. This is what he writes. He writes to European Talmidei Chachamim, nothing will be left for you to do except dressing in black, wrapping yourself in shrouds, and rolling from darkness to darkness, from factory to sweatshop, to itinerant peddling. For such great success, you don't need America. You don't need to endanger your life by crossing great stretches of water. There in your homeland, in your own little city, you can do just as well if you work diligently and put all fears of shame behind you. And here he is pleading with Rabbanim, don't come to America. There's nothing for you to do in America. What kind of panasa will you make in America? You'll have to go from shop to shop. You'll have to go from the sweatshop to the street. You'll have to knock on doors. Stay at home. Don't come. And he couldn't make a living. He fought. He went from shul to shul. He got involved in kashrut. He had to make money on the side. Balabatim resented it. This is America. A rabbi should not be involved with money. balabatim make money. Rabbis have to cater to their congregants, cater to the shul, not be involved in money. It's not seemly. It's not nice. You're a clergyman. And finally, he gets involved in baking matzah. Because one thing about Jews, they have a deep attachment, even if they're totally irreligious, but on Pesach, they have to have matzah. Even the great communist government allowed the Jews to bake matzah. They gave them flour. Whether the flour could be used for matzah is a different story, because the flour was not washed. It could have been wet. It could have been washed on purpose. It could be that vitamins were added to the flour. In Russia, they had a tremendous problem because the food was not like the Western world. It was not on the same level. The food was not as rich. Fruits and vegetables were not that available. You have to understand what communist Russia was like. It's in a very cold country. You can get what grows in the ground. Potatoes, onions, beets are available. But beyond that, there was very little. So they added vitamins to the flour, they added vitamins to the milk, they added vitamins to the bread, that the people should be healthy. And also, they have a tremendous problem with vodka. It's a cold country, and a lot of people drink, and I don't have to tell you, with all the drinking, you destroy your inner system, the life expectancy under the communist. Men did not have life expectancy above 50 plus years, way behind the Western world. So, but they still had to make flour available because Jews wanted matzah for Pesach, even if they were totally assimilated, they were communist, they didn't know a word about Shabbos, but you have to eat matzah on Pesach. When he got involved in the matzah business, he had a part-time job in a Hungarian shul. Well, believe it or not, they were balabatim in the shul who also had a matzah business. They got so angry at the rabbi that a fight broke out in the shul. A riot took place. The police had to be called. It's like Bavov. I told you the story of Bavov a few years ago. Malka and I got an early Shabbos. I got the earliest minyan I could in Borough Park in my neighborhood. It's a 7:30 minyan. So 7:30, you finish by 9:30, you go home, you make Kiddush. No, your wife wants to go for a walk. We got to see what Borough Park looks like on Shabbos. So we walk to Bavov. And above it, it's a Beis HaMikdash, what they have there. It's second only to Bells. Bells has the main Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, and Bavov has the second Beis HaMikdash in Borough Park. Have you ever been to Bavov? Oh, what a sight, an entire block, what a shul. Come to the shul, police are outside the shul, two police cars, policemen, policewomen. So, you know, we're Americans. We go over to the police. What the heck are you doing here? I said, we're visiting from Jerusalem. So this policewoman says, well, don't you know there were riots here last week over who should be the rabbi? And they were throwing chairs at each other. And she said, this week we're here in case the riot breaks out. Again, we're right here on the spot. I said, oh boy, this is fabulous. And then I read, there was Taka, if you recall, there was a tremendous battle between the grandson of the Rebbe and the grandson-in-law, or the son of the Rebbe and the son-in-law, whatever. I may be missing a generation. And you follow me, Ellie? Tremendous riots. So that's what happened on the shul. He had to leave. Very, very sad story. Now, this is what you came up with, Shalom, and you're absolutely correct. Rabbi Weinberger's main panasa came about because of matzah baking. In 1916, another man on the east side became his partner. Can anyone tell me the name of that man? No? Aaron Streitz. What came out of that partnership? Streitz matzahs. And that, of course, Streitz matzahs, today it's the only matzah outside of Manischewitz in the United States. Manischewitz, a giant, beginning in Cincinnati, ultimately swallowed up Goodman's, Horowitz Margaretten, And all the matzah you buy in America is baked in the big Matan Manshevitz plant. I don't know if they still do it, but I know that in the 1980s, 1990s, they still sold matzah, Howitz Margareten, Goodman's, Manashevitz. It was all exactly the same. Why did they sell three different types? One, to create a concept of competition. An American, it's not communist Russia. An American loves competition. So they had three different matzah. One matzah was $1.70 a pound, one was $1.79 a pound, and one was $1.65 a pound. And people would swear, this is the Goodman's taste that I tasted in this matzah back in 1925 when I first used Goodman's. Baloney! It was Manashevitz under a Goodman label. But Stripes remained independent. And I need not tell you, you know yourself, it was under Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. Then already people started yelling a few years ago. An individual, how do you give a heksha? You need a public heksha. So today it's under the supervision of the Chafkei and Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. I still remember when Baron Soloveitchik took over the heksha. I have a picture in my work on the Rav, where all the famous Rabbanim went to Streit's factory to bake shmur matzah with Rabbaran Soloveitchik to give him shtolzkeit. And Rabbaran, what can I tell you, if he gave a heksha, I would eat off the floor. But that Streit comes from Rav Moshe Weinberger. Very interesting. He died in 1940. Did he leave descendants who are from? I tried my best to check whether we have any names. I couldn't come up with anything. I don't know. It could be that listening to us across the world are people who are descendants of Reb Moshe Weinberger. It would be very interesting to know if his children survived the passage of time and remained Jewish in the United States. Because remember, they were born in the land of the 1800s. And as far as I know, there's not one living descendant alive of Rabbi Jacob Joseph today. So I wonder with Rav Moshe Weinberger. Weinberger is a popular name, so we all know Weinbergers who studied in the Kollel, studied in other institutions, Rabbanim who are Weinberger, but descendants, I do not know. Now, what did this man contribute? He tried to be a Rav, he tried to organize a good Talmud Torah, but he had tremendous insight. And in his description, and the description is worth turning into a movie, I'm reading now, describing page 40, 41 in the book, page 42, he describes endless synagogues. All over the east side, you had big shoes, little shoes, rooms. He says there were probably no less than 300 Jewish houses of worship on the lower east side. But what went on? They davened quickly, everyone had to run to work. He describes in some shuls they might have a shir after davening, but no one could concentrate. They were looking at their watches. They have to be in the sweatshop. They have to run to work. No one has time to learn. I was just watching the Siyum Hashas. I'm about 5.5 hours. Rabbi David came by and fed him on a higher level than he is with a computer. I said, you're a young man yet. You're in your 60s. I learned I was over 70 when my Talmud from this classroom, David Katz taught me how to use a computer. So I learned a little bit, Baruch Hashem. So I'm watching the Siyum, and they're interviewing now. They had these, everyone looked, they had big screens set up in the stadium, and they're showing people who learned Daf Yomi. And you hear the same thing, people saying, what, the great thing about Daf Yomi? We have to force ourselves. You follow me? These are not people like Rekefid, right, that Kevin never made a penny in his life, but his whole life is learning, his whole life is scholarship, his whole life is perpetuating Torah. Right or wrong, you guys know me, you guys see me, watch, you know what time I arrive in the building, what I do from a 6:15 in the morning to approximately 9:15 here, then in my house afterwards, but say the Baruch Hashem. These are business people, but they have to force themselves. See, 150 years ago, no one forced himself. And I had a big slip interviewing the various guys on Daf Yomi. There's my Talmud, Beryl Phillips. And Morty Carrigan will say, Edit Nemana, that the Rebbe called his office in America. Neil, why did I call his office? Tell me, Josh, why did I call his office? Because I don't want to wake him up. He's in New York. What's the middle of the night? I call his office. I get an answering machine. But when he comes to work at 9 o'clock in the morning, he's going to have a good laugh today because the Rebbe saw him at the Siyum talking about that he finished Shas. Beryl David Phillips. David Beryl Phillips finished Shas. Now we have to give him peace. He's not a young man. He's paid his price, Yitzchak. Vahame vinyavin. Okay, he's gone through. And thank God, happily today, Baruch Hashem. Okay, so he gives the description. He describes the Balabatim. Sweet singing Chazanim is more important than rabbis, judges, preachers, expositors of the Talmud. They prefer 1 hour of contentment in the community hall to all the joy, satisfaction, and spiritual pleasure that their fathers found in studying the Torah. He is very insightful. It's an upside-down world. If you remember the Gemara in Baba Batra, when one Amora looked at the next world and he came back to life, he said, and they asked him, what did you see there? Olim hafucha nirawe. You follow me, Josh? An upside-down world. The big people here are little people there. And the little people here are big people there. And here he describes what happens to the Balabas in America. And boy, I can tell you, nothing has changed. Number one, they become more refined. See, a Balabas in America, you Americanize. You might still, let's take the year 1880. No, you don't speak a proper English. There's still an accent. You're still a bissel a greenhorn. You're still, you understand? But you're more refined. Sunday, you wear a suit, a tie. You don't go to work. All right. Refined. You go to the Yiddish theater. But my grandparents, my grandfather never missed my grandfather, my mother's side. My grandfather who learned in Volozhin in America. The Yiddish was like a temple of worship for him. Wow. Not only that, in America, and this is what I told you, every Balabas has the right to express an opinion. And this is one of our great problems today in synagogues. Every Balabas can buy a membership, whatever it costs, $100 a year, $200 a year, $500 a year. Mr. Smallness, at work, he's a nobody. His boss is yelling at him. He comes home, his wife pounces on him. Take out the garbage, right or wrong. You've heard that charge? The Jewish women, no, they collect garbage from all the neighbors. So when the husband comes home, he knows that his wife is the boss. Take out the garbage. Jackie Mason's line. Not Jackie Mason. The big yeshiva boy who became a comic. He was a better comic than a yeshiva boy. That's Jackie Mason. His brother's a mazer. Rabbanim, Talmidei Chachamim. But he's Jackie Mason. The Jewish women collect garbage from every neighbor on the block. The husband comes on. Yankala, take out the garbage. Then he goes to shul. Then he goes into the shul. Rabbi, I wish to express my opinion. And this Amoritz, everyone has an opinion. For $500 a year, he is a member. He has an opinion. He can tell the rabbi off. Then he goes, he's very insightful in America. No, in Europe, what was the shul? Shul was everything. Was davening, was your social hall, was your Lashon Hara group. Everything took place in the shul. Now, what did you have on the east side? Lodges. Lodges. It's an American invention. Anyone who came from Tzuvak, the Tzuvak Brotherhood of Lodges, anyone who came from the greater Vilna area, every community in Europe had a lodge on the east side. And what went on in these lodges? It took the place of a shul. Outside of davening, your whole social life switched to the lodge. Yes? Landsmannschaft, exactly, a Landsmannschaft. I'm using the Americanized term already. When it began as a Landsmannschaft, and 20 years later became a lodge. And you, if you don't believe me, just go to any old cemetery. Go to Mount Hebron Cemetery in Queens, okay? Avi, have you been in Queens lately? Right? Queens, where did you grow up? You! Teaneck, the Queens is not the end of the world, but I see already you don't know the first thing what I say. I said, obviously. Danny, where did you grow up? In Teaneck? Go to Queens, Mount Hebron Cemetery. I have all, Malka and I have all our 8 grandparents buried in the same cemetery. Can you believe it? And Malka has great grandparents and great great grandmother buried in the same cemetery. So you go to Queens, walk up and down. Who owns the plots of lands? You don't see one name of one shul. Tanispola Lodge, Vilna Lodge, Tzuvalka Lodge. You follow me? This was their whole life. When the fraternity, the lodge, America has left its impact. And then he comes at the end, and here I'm going to show you the real McCoy. He ends off pleading with the Jews in Europe. Give me 1 second, Josh. Pleading. Don't come to America. You have nothing to gain. Now, dear reader, you'll be able to understand, if you have any feelings at all, how much satisfaction and benefit these tanners receive from their current situation, people who work with leather. You should be able to tell your friends in Russia, Poland, and Hungary what 1 hour of pleasure in an American community hall really is. I deeply regret to tell you, stay home. My heart within me rages, and my soul feels degraded. I abstain from merrymaking in America. Sighs and bitter tears are more appropriate here. Stay home. Watch. Josh.
2 questions, if I may?
Even 3.
I think that'll be okay with it. First of all, this is all Moshe Weinberger writing.
1870s, 1880s, yeah.
He didn't, it's not an autobiography. This is something that was collected in a biography.
No. The biography was put in by the editor, by Sana. This is his writing.
He's writing this.
Right. It's probably letters he wrote as well, but he put it together as a book.
Now, what? Did he send it back to Europe to be published?
No. In those days, what he probably did was published in New York as a fundraiser for this Talmud Torah. He tried to organize. And I would imagine copies were sent back to Europe.
Meaning, is this, is he like specifically trying to tell them not to come, or is this more like a general, don't come?
No, he is trying, you'll see in a moment, he is telling people not to come. And he wants to save Judaism, and if you come to America, you're going to assimilate, your children are not going to be Jewish, and it's the end of Yiddishkeit. And that's the message he wants to reach Europe.
Okay.
And I'm going to show you. I'm right in a minute. Yeah.
The lodges.
Yeah.
Is that an Americanism that was brought into Judaism, or did the Jews bring it over from Europe?
In Europe, to the best of my knowledge, and I can't say I'm an expert in the field, Jews had a shul. They didn't have a lodge.
The
shul fulfilled everything. Took care of burial. Took care of. Like, you listen. You've learned Shas and Paiskim. The shul did everything. The Chevra Kadisha, the Shtat Rav, everything functioned. You follow me? In America, the shul was simply for davening or hearing a chazan, or maybe an itinerant preacher if you were frum and wanted to hear one. But the lodge was the social group. That's where you expressed yourself. That's where you Americanized. That's where you took your wife. That's where you dressed up for the annual dinner. You follow me? That was the lodge. Yeah.
To stay home means in Eastern Europe.
In Russia. No, he's writing to Hungary, Poland, Russia.
Freedom and democracy.
Yeah, no, in Eastern Europe. He's writing to the East Europeans who are starting to come to America. Stay at home. So that's just what I'm going to touch upon. This is what I alluded to last week, and now I'll give you the source. We got involved with the whole question of Das Torah. I could have just drilled the concept of Das Torah. I'm not here to repeat the lectures. But I want you to understand something. If I was a rabbi in Europe in 1880, and if Yitzchak was a rabbi in 1880 in Europe, I guarantee you we would have told people not to go to America. Okay? So you'll say Das Torah? There's no such thing as Das Torah. It's not a Torah concept. It doesn't exist in Torah. I gave you all the sources last year. You want to know how to deal with life? Study the Rav's Chamesh Drashot when he deals with Yosef Yechov. It's overwhelming. But a Rav, you see, you can't fault the Rav for saying what he said, because he can only function within the reality of where he is at that moment in time. None of us can see the future black and white. We hope for the future. We hope for redemption. We hope for Mashiach Tzidkenu b'mehera b'yameinu. But we have to live a normal life. So I don't want you to get hysterical. How could Rabbi Weinberg be so stupid? And is Joseph Begun just deluded if anyone didn't come in Aliyah? Because as Josh said, they got a letter from him. They got this book. That didn't come upon me, didn't emigrate to America, cross out the word Aliyah. If anyone didn't emigrate to America, they were later killed by Hitler. What survives? They later suffered under the communist. What survives? Can you blame Rabbi Weinberger? I don't think so. But this is a tremendous refutation of Das Torah. I've told you more than once, I heard from the Rav, when you're arguing with the Chassid, you can knock him out of the box with two questions. It's the Rav speaking, not Rakefet. Number one, you're such a good chassid, how come you daven 9:30 in the morning after Zman Kriyat Shema? No, who is a Chabadnik? Chabadnikim all over the world don't daven earlier than 9:30 Shabbos morning. Yoni, am I right or wrong? 9:30. It's terrible. No, what do you say? Then the second point you knock him out of the box is, what did you do Shmini Atzeres and Chutz Laretz? Did you eat in the sukkah or didn't you eat in the sukkah? No? The Gemara says openly, Masechet Sukkah Tav Mem Zayin Omer Aleph, Yatev Yatzvinim Boreich Loma Varchinim. You sit in the sukkah, you don't make a bracha. Chassidim don't sit in the sukkah. Rakefet gave lectures years ago to explain it all and to justify the Chassidim. But I don't want to justify them now. I want to put them against the wall and slap their face. They can't crawl out of it. You're going against an open Gemara. I have, believe me, Shalom, I know why they do it, and I can justify it, but it's not for now. Now we have to understand the attack. Same thing with Das Torah. Das Torah, I'm going to give you a source in a minute. If anyone tells you, Das Torah, that the rabbis are infallible, great rabbonim are infallible, just ask this source, and the state of Israel, what we spoke about last week. We're sitting in the state of Israel today. We're all part of the Memshalah. There's so many from Jews, Kanayin Hara. And we have Jewish sovereignty before Mashiach. No, go back to my lectures on what the Rebbaruch Berlebowitz had to say about Jewish sovereignty before Mashiach. But it doesn't take away from Berchber's greatness. Understand me well. Rabbanim are only human beings. We can only answer Yiftach b'daro k'shmul b'daro. Ein l'dayan ela ma'ashein avrawat. Now, you want to know where you see exactly the same thought written a few years later, but during this period, as Reb Moshe Weinberger. I introduce you to a volume, The Silver Era, Rabbi Eliezer Silver and his generation. If anyone wants to make money, talk with me after class. I'll give you the rights to publish it, to republish a fourth edition. You'll make a bundle of money. I'll waive all, royalties. I'm getting so much double talk. I'm waiting for Sherry to come back. There should be an email waiting for me. But you don't know how much Akvitz Nefesh I had. People don't love Torah. In our world, we have a lot to learn from the Haredim. The Haredim respect their Gedolim. We do not. Our modern so-called Orthodox Jewish world has a lot of fault, and there's a lot that we have to learn from the Haredim. They have to learn from us, we have to learn from them. And one of the things we have to learn from Art Scroll is the love, the reverence for Gedolei Torah. Show me an Art Scroll book that's out of print. The minute there's a demand, they issue a new edition. Here, I'm crawling. Well, excuse me?
JPS published books, not on the basis.
This day they know we're bringing money, but they don't give a hoot. They don't give a who cares, Rabbi Revel, Rabbi Silver. They only built Torah in America. They don't give a hoot. It's not a question of a bestseller. When you republish a book today, the investment is a few thousand dollars. That's all. It's a money. It's a sure, absolute money maker. You're not setting type. You're not starting from scratch. Hey, let it be. So Manzain gives him. What a volume, the Silver Era. Okay. Beginning on page 17, I'm quoting how much the Rabbanim suffered in America, what they saw here. The first ordained rabbi to reach America, we're going to talk about him in great depth later today and next week. And it's costing Morty Tarrigan 36 to the IOU list because he comes from the Baltimore area. And we're talking about why Baltimore remains a bastion of Torah until today. Because the first ordained rabbi went to Baltimore. Rab Avraham Ries later becomes Rab Avraham Rice, Rice, R-I-C-E. So he writes a letter to his Rebbe in Central Europe, Rav Wolf Bamberger. And one thing I wish to disclose to you, my revered teacher, and my soul weepeth on the dark on account of it, namely that the character of religious life in this land is on the lowest level. Most of the Jews eat non-kosher food, violate the Shabbos in public. Thousands have been assimilated and married non-Jewish women. Under these circumstances, my mind is perplexed. Can I live in a land such as this? Nevertheless, in my own home, thank God, I conduct myself as I did in the days of old in my native country. I study Torah day and night. And my devoted and God-fearing wife is always standing by and helping me with all her strength in spite of all the difficulties. Yet in spite of this, life has lost all meaning here. On account of the low spiritual state of our people. Alas, my master and teacher, impart to me of your wisdom and give me your opinion in this matter, for I'm about to make up my mind to leave and go back to Europe and put my trust in the good Lord. So you see, Rab Avram Rice is ready to go back to Europe. He has had it with the United States. Yes, Morty.
Part of the thing, I don't know if it's cause or effect, but all with all the nedidim in these communities, the rabbanim of those times were paid pennies.
Right, no,
it was a lack of respect, and that caused...
Yeah, no, we have no Rabbanus in America yet. We're going to get there. You're absolutely right. You'll see. We're going to do Rice's life. You have no idea who that man was. Most of the students never heard the name until now, but give me a chance. Now, you think he was an individual? With all due respects, Ellie. Reb Moshe Rice, Reb Moshe Weinberger, Mi lanu yoter gadol ben the Chafetz Chaim. And you know, the Yisrael Meir HaKohen. Chafetz Chaim we're talking about. A Talmud, a friend of mine, call him what you wish, just asked the Brisker Rav, he heard from me, by the way, your father, Yoni, evidently what the rabbi gave him the Shulchan Aruch's opinion. But it's impossible that, I can't believe that the rabbi said this was the Rav's opinion. I checked with other Talmudim of the Rav this morning, and everyone said it is absolutely known by everyone that the Rav quoted Reb Chaim time and again that in Israel it's one day, in America it's 2 days. It has nothing to do with the community you belong to. It has to do with where your feet are. It's exactly like the Mitchat Zaglala, exactly like the Chacham Tzvi. But evidently the rabbi gave him a yes, the Shiley told me, but to say the Rav said it, it's impossible, impossible. And the Rav didn't change his mind, because I spoke with the Rav about this topic for hours in 1978, and that was towards the very end of the Rav, when he was still able to be a public figure and was totally with it and with the community. Understand what I'm saying? Okay, but anyway, the Chafetz Chaim, so a Talmud of mine, a friend of mine went over. He has a good friend, a big Talmud Chacham, who learned with the Rav. And when these are people who have a home here, a home in America, and when his friend comes for Yontif, he observes one day. So and his friend told him that he heard from the Rav in the name of Reb Chaim that in Israel you observe one day. If you're not here for the three regalim, so you shouldn't do malacha the second day, but that's a chumrah. So he went to Reb Meshulam David, one of the Brisker Rav's surviving sons, and Reb Meshulam David, or he went to the Einikel now, Reb Avram Gershon, I think the name is, the grandson, and Reb Avram Yeshua, thank you. Reb Avram Yeshua, correct. Gershon is a different part of the family. Reb Avram Yeshua, and Reb Avram Yeshua opens the Mishnah Brura, and he says, what's the Shaila? And he reads to him, like that rabbi told your father that this is what you do. You when you're here, you have to observe 2 days, you belong to the community. And he sort of made believe he didn't know anything about what Reb Chaim said. I don't know how that's possible, but we live in a world where anything is possible. But the awe that Reb Meshulam David had for the Chafetz Chaim, the Mishnah Brura, as if to say, when you open a Mishnah Brura, this is it. You can't argue. Mishnah Brura, Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim wrote a beautiful volume. 1894 it was published. Nidche Yisrael. As I told you, in every shul I ever davened as a kid, there were 7-8 copies of that, because everyone sent it to their relatives in America. In the shul I daven every morning at the 5:30 minyan, there's a copy of the Nidche Yisrael right in front of me, but it's falling apart. I can't even lift it up, because the yellow pages are crumpling. And here's the way the Chafetz Chaim ends the Nidche Yisrael, translated into English in the Silver Era. My brethren, after all that I have written in this volume to strengthen those who dwell in distant lands, there is still only one proper solution. Whoever wishes to live properly before God must not settle in those countries. Even if he has already emigrated due to financial distress, he must return to his home where the Lord will sustain him. He must not be misled by thoughts of remaining away until he is financially wealthy. A proper person should curse the day of his arrival in a land where he must constantly witness desecration of the Torah. All his expectation should be directed towards God's helping him to go free and return home. Certainly, he must vow never to bring his children where they, God forbid, may be lost among the Gentiles. The choice is given to the individual who truly fears the Lord to return to his homeland, where he can inculcate his children with Torah values. Then he will be blessed in this world and the next. God will not forsake the righteous who observe his covenant and commandments. My dear friends, that is the Chafetz Chaim speaking. Wow. Powerful. Absolutely correct. If I was a Rav in Europe in 1884, 1894, I would sign on with the Chafetz Chaim. And boy, just think for a moment, had my grandparents gone back, and you know the story, my grandfather already booked passage to return to Russia. He was so unhappy in America, single teenage kid, saved up money, booked passage. A week or two before he was to leave, he got a telegram from his parents. It was the 1905 Russo-Japanese War. Funya has drafted you. Funya is the Russian word for the Tsar. What does Funya mean? That's the word they use in Yiddish. Funya has drafted you. Because of that, my grandfather did not go back. Could you imagine, those of you that are fourth and fifth generation Americans here, had your great-grandparents come back, where you would be today, if you'd be alive. So it's fascinating. This is Reb Moshe Weinberger. This is the Chafetz Chaim. Same period, but that's the way they viewed America. Yes, Yitzchak?
In 1880, he started to put marks.
Right.
1900,
correct.
So you had people, the majority came to America. But there were a few trickling to Palestine. So now the question is, think of yourself now, you're a rabbi in Russia, and you don't want to tell people to go to America because it's trade. What about going to Palestine?
Okay, so what about going to Palestine? What did Palestine, illness, sickness, malaria, every torture under the sun, suddenly Jews have to become farmers, tilling the land. Not so simple. But what you're saying, you say it and quote the Rav, that the Hashgacha Pratit tells us that the religious Zionists had the right approach. And those who went and suffered, they're alive today. Thousands of descendants. What a land. And who knows, everything the Ribbono Shel Olam does. I mean, I don't want to play games, but who would ever dream the anti-Semitism in France, the bastion of democracy, the world, the country that gave the world Western democracy, England. Who would ever dream? Scandinavian countries, Norway, Denmark. The anti-Semitism today. Switzerland, Shchita, Brit Mila. And take a look what's happened in Jerusalem. I walk from my house to my daughter's house on Shabbos midday to pick up my grandchildren to go to Daven Mincha and their shul. It's about an 8-9 minute walk. I hear endless conversations in French. Everyone's coming in Aliyah. Miracles are happening. You have to have tremendous foresight and Hashgacha Pratit and Siyata Deshmaya to make the right choice. And that's the Rav in Yosef Yechav. We have to look up. It's not halacha. Halacha, we never look up. We decide. Lo nitna Torah l'malachei hasharet. The Gemara in Bab Metzia, Daf Nun Tet, we tell God na halachic matter, lo me'eva hayam hi. Nothing to do with the Ribbono Shel Olam. You gave it to man. Man has the paskin. That's halacha. We ain't somchin al habakkal. We paskin here on earth, human mind. Hashkafa, have all the opinions in the world, you have to evaluate. A year later, 2 years later. If I could have been at the Siyum, I would have given a different talk entirely. And I would have challenged 92,000 Jews to come on Aliyah, la'alot atza berina, to hear the kol shofar that is blowing. You are needed so desperately. There's so much you can do with your lives. Every minute of your existence, a kiyum d'oraita of mitzvat yishuv, Eretz Yisrael. Wow. But that's what I believe. I bow my head. Others believe differently, but Baruch Hashem, the Aliyah is there, the progress is there. Ashrei Ayin Ra'at Hazot. Optimistic, we have to be. Let's go further. He is fabulous here. Has a whole chapter on the lack of Jewish education in the United States. His insight, the first paragraph, is exactly what Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik said time after time after time. He came to Boston, he came to New York, Rabbi Weinberger, you found from Jews, Elohim Jews, good Jews. Only one part of religion was lacking. They had no faith in their ability to pass on Yiddishkeit to their children. They reached the point where they were perfectly satisfied to be from themselves, but their kids are totally Americanizing, totally assimilating, and totally lost. And this chasm, this abyss, this split, they couldn't overcome it. And I can tell you, in my own family, I had a grandmother on my father's side, a tzaddeket. I have relatives here who tell the stories their great-grandparents only ate in one person's home. It was my grandmother's home. A tzaddeket. And my father once said to her, how does she feel that her children are assimilating? And she answered, if the Ribbono Shel Olam can take care of the Goyim, so there's one more Mechalel Shabbos in the world I don't have to take care of too. In other words, there was that attitude that there is nothing we can do. And that was lacking. And it's a terrific insight that he shares with the Rav. But then he describes, and here he's genius. My dear students, how many of you were Mesayim Shas a few weeks ago? No, what's the last Mesechet you learned? Mesechet Nida. Daf Lamed Amid Bet. Beautiful description of the Gemara, how a embryo spends its 9 months in its mother's womb. The Malach is teaching you Kol HaTorah Kula. And then when you're about to be born, what does the Malach do? No, touches you under your nose, that's the cleft, it's the indentation, and you forget everything you know. Right? An open Gemara, right or wrong? Okay. Josh, do you understand that Gemara? It's not for now, believe me. The Rav taught me how to understand. But Daf Lamed Amid Bet. Sechet Nida. Daf Lamed Amid Bet. Let me just check the list here. Am I missing anyone? Shmuel, Eli, Wagner, Moshe, Spira, Sam Frumson, Josh Berman, Yoni Miller, Moshe Raps, Nathaniel Fishman, Daniel Abraham, Danny Schulman, Charlie and Morty, Josh Guttenberg, I have everyone, I believe. Gentlemen, he describes bar mitzvah education. He says, a kid goes to Talmud Torah. He learns a little bit Chumash. He learns how to make the Birchat HaTorah. He learns how to read the Haftorah. And then when the kid turns 13, He finishes with his studies. The malach touches under his nose once again, and he forgets everything he knows. Weinberger has a very sharp mind. At the very end of this chapter, education, he says, if I can paraphrase it, I'm sure this is what he wrote in Hebrew, Shmua Shamati. I now heard a rumor that they're trying to organize a real yeshiva here with a curriculum of Mishnah and Talmud. I now heard a rumor, and he says this would be the greatest blessing for America. Halavai that this rumor should be true. I'll do everything I can to help. So you see, this is Moshe Weinberger. Insightful, understood what's happening in America, understood the American balabas, Hungarian himself, but for many years lived on the Lower East Side of New York, tried to make a living, a bit of a rabbi, a bit of a chvei samacha, a bit of a dashen, but ultimately got involved in matzah baking, and out of the matzah baking, he made a living. That matzah baking turned into strites.
Did he or did he not? Was he known as a philanthropist? This is Shiva that he said he heard a rumor about.
Heard a rumor, it's just...
Which is going to be YU.
Which ultimately...
Did he give any money?
How did he give money? Who said he had money at that point in life?
No, he just told us that he left the rabbit and he was suffering with all the...
Yeah, but that's 1914 that he starts making a living. Here we're talking 1880s. Baruch HaTot Melech Olam
Shekel. So in other words, 1914 he had the money, and 1880 he didn't yet get it.
He's a nobody yet. My dear friends, the first rabbi to come to America that we know of, that had real smicha, and was a real Talmud Chacham, was Avraham Yosef Ries. Ries is the original name. Later, his name was Americanized to Rice, R-I-C-E. Why Rice is more American than Ries, I don't know today, but evidently Ries was a German name, and Rice was an Americanized name. His years... Believe it or not, we're not sure of the year of his birth. Approximately 1800, 1862. Now, he was privileged that a rabbi who's still alive today, probably is in his 90s, I would imagine, Rabbi Harold Schaffman, did a doctorate on him for Bernard Rebel Graduate School of Yeshiva University. He got his doctorate before I did. He's older than I am. He's the younger brother of Rabbi Solomon Schaffman of Flatbush, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, if that means anything to you. His brother was a very prominent rabbi, member of the RCA. I would say Rabbi Solomon Schaffman, Rabbi Zalman Schaffman was one of the leading rabbinic figures in the United States. This is his younger brother, Rabbi Harold Schaffman. You know Rabbi Harold Schaffman because in your parents' library they have a 5-volume English translation of Rashi, a blue volumes into English. It was the first time Rashi was translated into English. Today it's outdated, art scroll. There may be another 4 or 5 different translations. It was the first attempt to put Rashi into English. I grew up in those volumes. And the main author, translator, was Rabbi Harold Schaffman. Now, his doctorate is published. It's called The First Rabbi, and it was published in must be about 30 years ago. It It's a very fascinating volume because he has endless pictures. Here's a picture of Rabbi Rice as a young man. Look at the determined look in his eyes. And he has endless pictures of the period and endless documents. It's a very fascinating volume. He did his work, and Yitzhak will be happy to hear this, under Rabbi Jacob Akis. So there's a real tie-in with Bernard Rebel Graduate School. Now, a few details, just to give you his life and put it... Under Avraham Yitzchak, what was it in Hebrew? Avraham Yitzchak Agis at Bernard Rebel Graduate School, if I'm not mistaken. And in English, his name was Erwin Agis. Okay.
Jacob Agis was
his brother in Baltimore. He did his doctorate under Rabbi Agis, Dr. Agis, Professor Agis, who was the person I did my MA under. I wrote my MA under Dr. Agis, and I'm always in debt to him because it wasn't his field of study, and the person who should have taken me, Dr. Lewin, Professor Lewin, was too busy, so I was able to work it out with Dr. Agis. Now, Rice's life, very fascinating. First of all, why did he leave Europe? He left Europe because he had a lot of heartache. His Rebbe, Rabbi Avraham Bing, who was one of the leading Rabbanim in Bavaria, Big Talmud Chacham, a Rav from the old school, died. His Rebbe died. He felt very, very depressed. And he had a chance now to go to America, to forget Europe, forget his heartache. And the Rabbanim, who were older, encouraged him to go because by the 1840s, there were thousands of Bavarian Jews in the United States. Go and have influence. Do what you can. Arrived in America, 1840. Now he has to find the shtetl. So first, they send him to Rhode Island, Newport News, Rhode Island. Who has been there? What do you have in Newport News? You have one of the oldest, if not the oldest, synagogue in America. And it's a Sephardic synagogue that for hundreds of years already has had an Ashkenazic Rav, and it remains Orthodox with a gallery for the women, because that is part of the Sephardic tradition. It's not that there were so many from Jews there. And you should know that the rabbi for many decades was a mere yeshiva student, Rabbi Lewis. I believe he was English origins or Scottish origins. He learned in Mir, got out before the Holocaust with miracles. He was in Shanghai, I'm not even certain, it has to be checked. And he wound up rabbi in Newport News, remained there all his life. Rabbi Rice goes to Newport News during the summer.
Newport, Rhode Island,
excuse me, during the summer, Newport, Rhode Island, during the summer, the place is mobbed, and after the summer, there's almost no one left, and he sees it's a summer resort. For whatever the reasons are, people ran away from New York, it was more north, it was colder, right, dealing with Rhode Island, you're beyond New York, you're further away, and there's no one there. And he sees that the town does not have commerce anymore. It's not like it was during the Revolutionary War when it was a center and a hub of commerce and industry. So he makes up his mind, it's not for him. Comes back to New York, meets a Landsmann from Bavaria, and he brings him to Baltimore. And he becomes Rav in Baltimore. And in Baltimore, this name of the shul, Nidchei Yisrael, he establishes a Talmud Torah, he's widely respected, questions come in to him from all over the United States. There's now a Rav with Smicha in Baltimore. But reform, the Balabatim are pressing. Those that are wealthy, they want to change this, they want to change that. In 1849, he resigns from the rabbinate goes into business, ultimately has a grocery store to support himself, and opens a shul in his house, has a minion morning and night like an overgrown shtibble, but he's no longer an official rabbi. In 1862, they plead with him, come back to Nitzchei Yisrael. And they agree, nothing will change, he'll remain Orthodox, they'll respect the Rav. He comes back and he dies a few months later. He was ill, he was old, and Nitzchei Yisrael within 10 years became a Reform synagogue. Now, did anyone remain Jewish from the family? Very fascinating question. I want you to know that in the computer you can get printouts of tens and tens of families that descend from Avraham Rice. I don't know if any of them are from, but one thing I can tell you, there's one family there, when I see all the names of the children, I am positive they are from. Do you know why? Because every last name is a Chabad name, and it tells you that this branch of the family at a certain point was picked up by Chabad and brought back totally, completely, belev v'nefesh, to our way of life. What makes Rabbi Rice very unique, that here you have this Talmud Chacham in Baltimore, widely respected by Jews who care about Shabbat and Kashrut, and for the first time, on four different occasions and four different points in his life, people talk about making him chief rabbi of the United States. For the first time, the words are spoken, the words that no one ever dreamt about, four different times, chief rabbi of the United States, Rabbi Avraham Rice. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, let's see the story of his rabbinate, and let's pave the way for the attempt that shakes the East European Torah world until this moment, the Rav HaKollel, Rabbi Jacob Joseph. My dear students, what have we done today so far? We are far from finished, but what have we done so far? Very fascinating. Rabbi Moshe Weinberger, the American immigrant scene, the East Europeans, the Balabas, the Nagid, money, the values, the chazan, the lodge, fabulous insight. The Bar Mitzvah boy, the Malach who didn't pinch him when he came out of the womb, but gave him a big pinch when he turned 13. Tremendous insight. Making a living, matzah, Aaron Streitz. When you go to the store in Borough Park and you want to buy Streitz matzahs, tell him you want the matzahs that are under the hashgacha of Reb Moshe Weinberger. And believe me, the storekeeper will throw you out and say you're crazy or order the police to come in. This man is Meshuga. What's he talking about, Moshe Weinberger? But tell him you're back in 1920, 1930, and you're dealing with Streitz's partner. Reb Avraham Rice. Fascinating story. A Talmud Chacham. A man with smicha, a man with knowledge, a man with insight. A man who suffered in America. The rabbinate, resignation, the private individual. And finally, the return, and so sadly, for such a short period. In 1871, an organ was introduced, the Reform Prayer Book was adopted, and Nidchei Yisrael went the way of all Reform temples. Okay. Now, give me 1 second. Danny brought to my attention Atlanta, Georgia is shaking. Young Israel of Atlanta. They had a women's Torah reading on Simchas Torah, where women read the Torah, women were called to the Torah. Rabbi Broid came out with a brief article against it. The women involved justified it. Another blog piece came out against them and against Rabbi Broid. And my humble opinion, I can't believe what I read here. It's exactly what I told you in class. The word by word, it's like I'm speaking. When that woman justifies, this is the biggest challenge Torah faces today. It is no different than the challenge that created the conservative movement 110 years ago. We are living in two worlds, and the Torah world has one lifestyle, the Western world has another lifestyle. And in the Western world today, any concept of family is being totally decimated. Women are men, men are women, with all that that implies, same-sex marriage, which is just beyond belief that in America today, court after court after court holds up the theory of same-sex marriage. It's a revolution against God. It'll be a miracle if the world is not destroyed. But all right, the Ribbono Shel'olam promised us he wouldn't destroy the world again. This is a tremendous challenge. A woman is right. She says, I can be a surgeon, and I can't be called up to the Torah.
Was this during the ordinary service, or did they go to a separate room?
No, they went to a separate room. It's a Young Israel. And the woman is saying, they want to do more. Yitzchak, you got to read them. You read. It's not... Yitzchak, relax yourself. Who said it's wrong? But it's the end of Yiddishkeit. Because you're starting a process, what you're allowed to happen here. Do you remember what the Rav said about these type of innovations? 1,000,000,000,000,000,000% opposed. But relax. You're telling me what the Rav said, and then what did the Rav say afterwards? The Rav said, if the Chatam Sofer had not been so extreme, perhaps reform wouldn't have been as extreme in Hungary. And then he said, but it could be the opposite. Had he not been so extreme, there would have been many more reformed Jews. But anyway, I want to... No. Yitzchak, relax yourself. The problem is real. And how do we find the balance between Torah civilization and the Western challenge? And this is a work in process right now. And on one hand, I will speak up very firmly and clearly. There's a man is a man, a woman is a woman, the family, children, responsibility, and creating a world where women put career ahead of family is a very frightening implication for the Torah world. Because you think ahead what it means with children and rearing children, etc. What Yitzchak said is correct, and I've paskened la halacha. If a rabbi is caught in a shul where the women insist upon having their own prayer group and they do it halachically, I don't believe you should leave the shul over that issue. We can live with it. The problem is, where do we go from here? And when you read the literature, when you read what these women want and what this teenage girl, and she must be a lovely girl, but they want to daven for the Amid. It's right here. This is just the start. And you're here with falling dominoes. This issue haunts us. Halavai, the Rav would be here to guide us and to put his foot down. Because when the Rav said something, the argument ended there. Today there's no one who has the Rav's influence. One second. Yeah. We have no one of that authority. But I want to tell you. But I want to show you something. This is amazing. This is the Yukon. The Yukon, anyone know what this is? This is the magazine section of Makor Rishon. Everyone know what Makor Rishon is? Makor Rishon is the first paper in the country that's on a popular level that is a religious Zionist paper. We've never had anything like Makor Rishon. The owner and publisher of Makor Rishon is now bidding for Mariv. So we may be in for sea changes in Israeli society. This is this past Friday's issue. This is an unbelievable article that everyone should read. I have to read more, not this. There's other articles I want to read in here. This is a former conservative rabbi who was the first Israeli ordained by JTS. She was dean of Shechter's seminary here. And this article, it's word by word, everything I believe. She says the straw that broke the camel's back is when the conservative movement recognized homosexual marriages, lesbians, and all that's going on today. And she writes about the breakdown of family. You have to read it to believe it. This is a liberal who has become a conservative with a big, little, small C. Beautiful, beautiful article. And I have to tell you, I agree with every word. And she hits the nail right on the head that we've neglected family, we neglect children. The lesbians and homos, the New York Times has created a feeling that if Rakefet says homosexuality is not normative, he's a criminal. He should be thrown into jail. He's a disgrace. He hates human beings. What an article. So these are real problems. I have my black and white answers, but I recognize it's a gray area right now. And halavai, we would have the Rav here to give us a little bit guidance. Finally, I want to tell you about the election. Some of you are taking the election too seriously. Elections, from the day I came in Aliyah, I was privileged to see election campaigns in Israel. I would give you some good advice. Enjoy the election campaign. The entertainment is fabulous. Try to look beneath the surface. What you do have beneath the surface, and here I want to say, I have never seen an election campaign like this where everyone respects Torah. It is beyond words. If you think for one moment the Avodah asked Tzomet from Gush Etzion, give us a microphone that we can use on Shabbos. Now you just think what I said. Danny Trapper, Rabbi Dr. Danny Trapper's son just joined. He's going to be a candidate for them. It's the Trapper family. He says, of course, I'm a religious Zionist, but we have to do for the poor people. He's joining Avodah. Wow, what respect. Shelly Achimovich, I can't believe we have nothing against religion. We love religion, quote, end quote. The Yair Lapid party, I can't believe a Rav just joined from Tzoha, and they're opening their campaign in Ariel. Enjoy every minute. They said, Ari, what are you doing in Ariel? He says, I'm an enlightened leftist. There's no difference today between small shafui via min shafui, an enlightened leftist and enlightened rightist. I can't believe what's going on. I go to Israel. It is a sight to see. You don't know the enmity. You read the Haredi papers. Agudat Yisrael, the enmity to the Litvakin to the Agudistim. Within Degel HaTorah, the split, the enmity. And they all join together. It's a miracle. Shas, it is fabulous. A triumvirate led by Ari Derry. And what he did to Yishai and Atias. Gentlemen, enjoy every moment of it. Not only that, above all, I got to tell you, have the whole election begin. Chok Tal, get every yeshiva boy into the army. Build the jails. Take in 50,000 yeshiva boys. Draft dodges. I haven't heard one word. Have you heard a word more? I haven't heard one syllable. Chok Tal, totally forgotten. No one wants to say a word against the Haredim. No one wants to. And in the background, they just arrested Rabbi Pinto. I couldn't believe what is going on, you know. Yeah, then a day later, his wife tries to commit suicide. It's not a joke. It's frightening. And this is a man, you got to know who is in his hands, who comes to him. So I end off with one little story how I get my face smacked. My grandson, who was here last week, he's now back in yeshiva, so he can't come. But my grandson, is an artist, so here the yeshiva, Hakolto, gave him permission every day he can take art lessons to get ready to go to Betzalel Be'ezrat Hashem a year from now when he finishes Hesda. So my wife is an artist, so we have a little studio in the house, and every Friday he comes and he works on his artwork. So he's working on his artwork, and I'm in the room where I was learning, and then the news comes on. And we listen to the news, and the big news is Rabbi Pinto. So my grandson says, how can Rabbanim do something like this, with a... So I say to him, you did, listen to me. If you meet one or two rabbis in your life who are not influenced by money, you're doing okay. You have to be happy you met such great rabbis. And by the way, one of them is in this room right now. And my grandson looks at me and he says, I don't know. I don't see Grant standing in the room. So Baruch Hashem, my grandson put me down. Okay, finally, I just entertain you one more minute because someone is here from Chicago. Eli, I have to tell you, I have the person who knows me best lives in Chicago. He's a guy named Harry Merrillis. You know him? This is his blog from last week. One of the most informative books I've ever read on the subject of early 20th century American Jewry was Rabbi Aaron Rakepitz's biography of Bernard Revel, the first president of Yeshiva University. And the picture painted of American Jewry in the Revel bio matches that of Rabbi Rakepitz's own autobiographical account of growing up in pre-World War era in New York. To put it simply, Orthodox Judaism as we know it today did not exist. The fact is that Rabbi Rakepitz reported that some of the rabbeim in his elementary religious day school were barely religious. Indeed, the general studies principal there, Harry Scherer, brother of Rabbi Moshe Scherer, ended up becoming a reform rabbi. And he goes on and on. What's the gist of it? That Yaakov Kamenetsky's son-in-law, Reb Hirsch Diskin, wrote about his Rebbeim and Chaim Berlin when he was a little kid, and he criticizes them because one of the Rebbeim cried when Chaim Nachman Bialik died. And he criticizes Diskin and Upsaida. Fascinating. The blog is Emes V'Yamuna. Rabbi Merrillis is a Talmud of Rabbarim Soloveitchik. Okay, finally, one gift. If anyone here is a Gabbai and Shul, this was Xeroxed. It's all the pages a Gabbai needs, and they don't need it anymore. Whoever Xeroxed it was for the summer programs here. And if anyone's interested, if you're a Gabbai or you want the Aliyah, you want the Mishaberach, and you want the Mishaberach LeKlal Yisrael, the Mishaberach for Medinat Yisrael, the Mishaberach for Tzva Haganali Yisrael, it's all there. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das V'danya. Thank you very, very much. Okay, I have caught up with everything I have to do.